I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, where our cover story this week is the pervasive influence today of ancient mythology.
Daddy! Hello, sugar.
How's my little girl?
He ain't our daddy.
I am the only daddy you got. I am the damn paterfamilias.
Now mama's got a new bed.
That's a trailer from the latest film by the Coen brothers, O Brother, Where Art Thou?, which is very loosely based on the Odyssey. The lead, played by George Clooney, is Ulysses Everett McGill, and he's trying to escape the chain gang he's on to make sure that his wife, Penny, doesn't divorce him to marry one of her suitors. Today in Studio 360, we're going to look at a lot of the ways in which ancient myths and some modern myths influence everything from movies like this one to novels and video games and all kinds of music. My guest and guide through this enchanted forest is Marina Warner, a novelist who also writes smart, lucid, nonfiction books about myth. She's the author of books about fairy tales, about the Virgin Mary cult, about why we like scary stories so much, and about how even the agendas of public policy are shaped and driven by ancient myths. Welcome to Studio 360, Marina.
Hello.
I recently opened the arts page of the New York Times and found page after page of reviews of new plays based on the Orpheus myth or Peter Hall's new Tantalus, 10.5 hours of it in Denver, and best-selling novels like Cold Mountain, which is another Odyssey-based novel. Why are we today in the 21st century still also moved by these old tales?
I think that partly they are extraordinarily rich reservoirs of almost every psychological combination you can think of both hates and, of course, loves. And the great themes of existence are addressed there all those thousands of years ago in stories like the Odyssey or the Iliad, that this is the scaffolding of not only our imagination, but also of our relationship to how we live our lives.
And do we embrace myth, do you think, as the power of traditional religion diminishes?
Yes, I think that that's a definite factor. I mean, that many historical things have contributed to that, probably the rise of psychoanalysis, which was so dependent on myth as well, certainly in America and to some extent in Europe. You know, this is an alternative way of charting the psyche. But I think that it's not just that religion has decayed or faded, because in some ways that's a very tricky question. It hasn't quite. It's more to do with the whole turn that the great globalized literacy of the 19th century and now the last century and now this one. And so story, narratives, and particularly myths that can be changed and recombined and told in different ways are the kind of storehouses of ways of being, of the examples that we can look for. We're looking, in a way, for heroes, heroines, patterns, and models, role models, and it goes sort of hand in hand a bit with the whole cult of celebrity, the way that, you know, we look at figures in the past. It's interesting that Penelope, you say in this movie, is about to marry one of the suitors because, of course, in the original Odyssey by Homer, she is fending them off, resisting them. And that's a perfect example of how a question of our time, the remarrying of women, circulates through the blood of the old story.
We'll continue to look at the mythic foundations of movies in a few minutes, and we'll eavesdrop on some college students as they portray the mythic characters in the game Dungeons & Dragons. I'm Kurt Anderson. Stay with me and my guest, Marina Warner, as Studio 360 continues on PRI, Public Radio International.
There is something I want. A friend.
A friend.
Come. Companion, a female, someone like me, so she won't hate me.
That was a scene from Kenneth Branagh's over-the-top adaptation of Mary Shelley's wonderful and enduring Frankenstein, starring Robert De Niro as the monster. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the novelist and essayist Marina Warner. Marina, in your book, Six Myths of Our Time, you talk about how we've missed the lesson, the real lesson of Frankenstein's monster.
The novel is extremely powerful, and one of its moments of sort of great depth is when the monster, you know, rails that he has been made into a monster by the treatment of all the people around him. Of course, the first being Victor Frankenstein, who made it and then shunned him the instant he was created. And this idea that you project monstrosity onto the other has been something that I've tried to confront. And in a recent book I wrote called No Go the Bogeyman, I look at how, unfortunately, the perennial terrors which we suffer from, night terrors, fear of the dark, fear of figures under the bed, which as children we both fear probably instinctively, but are also encouraged to fear by the literature, materials, songs and so forth that surround us as children, that very unfortunately this figure is often identified with some stranger or outsider to the community, to the host community. So this is why we have to never underestimate the power of the imagination. I take issue with people who want to live by reason, not because I'm against living by reason, but because I think if you try and split reason from fantasy or reason from imagination and say that you can disentangle them and that all we need is a kind of reasonable society and we don't, you will ignore the difficulty that we live as part of our lives through our dreams, part of our lives through our most irrational fantasies. Now, I don't want to encourage them. I don't want to overexcite them. I certainly
don't. But we ignore them at our peril.
We ignore them at our peril. We need to nourish them and foster them and shape them, as I think Mary Shelley was actually really doing. So extraordinarily, I mean, that is one of the few modern myths. I mean, it's a book, an original story, a very, very, very remarkable original story in which she confronted the dangers not only of overreaching, the sort of Faustian idea of the man of science overreaching, trying to be God, but also looked at the, you know, where we began, the idea that if the creature had been taught language, had been taught laws, had been brought in, had been cherished and loved, I mean, it may sound, you know, very namby-pamby, but nevertheless, I believe that. I mean, it's an old liberal view, but I do believe it.
I'm Kurt Anderson, talking with the author Marina Warner about the powerful contemporary appeal of myth. Marina, in your book, Six Myths of Our Time, there's a chapter called Boys Will Be Boys, about the ways in which we create our images of masculinity today based on violent mythic themes. In that chapter, you seem to agree with the person we heard in the piece that certain kinds of role-playing games can be potentially mentally healthy for the players.
I think that the idea, the concept of living through imaginary roles, as that drama therapist was saying, I do endorse that very strongly. But on the other hand, we do see in the role-playing game one of the problems, which is the absence of women. And it's just that I want to see as rich a fan, a rich gamut of possible parts for the feminine gender to occupy. And I don't necessarily think that it should be I think that there should be more cross-gender play. Now, I think that that is beginning to happen, especially on the internet, because I don't think we necessarily have to occupy our social genders when we are being imaginary. Because one of the things that myth shows us, one of the ways it does teach us and instructs us, is it opens up possibilities which then define borders. One of the many areas that turn up in myths is prohibition. You get many myths that are about how you mustn't commit incest. Obviously,
you violate Oedipus. Taboos. Or
yes. You mustn't kill strangers. The first
cannibalism being one of
yes,
the great myths.
Exactly.
Great taboos.
Yes.
Myth.
And the very first metamorphosis in Ovid's poem is the man who transgresses the laws of hospitality, and he is turned into a werewolf by the gods, condemned forever to feast on raw flesh because he's been a wicked host, who has actually served up a man. Okay, he's a cannibal, so he's become a werewolf. Now, so one of the areas that it isn't just that you, I mean, it isn't what your interviewee was saying about expressing violence as a cathartic method of getting rid of it in that way, because I think that's a little bit, one can argue about that. What it is learning where the rules lie for you when you are in the world as a social citizen. This is what fairy tales do for children. Fairy tales don't just offer models of good behavior, you know, you please be like Cinderella or Snow White.
They demonstrate justice and retribution as well.
Yes, they demonstrate the limits of wickedness and its punishments, and that is a lesson for everyone. It's much more simple in fairy tale than in myth, and it's one of the differences between them, if you like.
What do you think? Are there any new stories to tell?
The force is known as the magical helper in the interpretations of the structuralists, the Russian formalists who interpreted fairy tales, and they said that there were only a certain finite number of stories in the world, and they had this exact structure. And one of them was always that there should be a magical helper. But, of course, the imagination creates the magical helper in so many different varieties and forms that it really, I think it's much too reductive, this idea of it being all, you know, a recipe, if you like.
Well, this is America. This is a reductive place.
Well, the interesting thing is that it really is a place where the individual creativity of the either the filmmaker or the poet shows. Because there are a number of compendia in the past of mythologies, none of which is read nowadays, but they're the source for many of our stories, because we only read Homer and Ovid. We don't read the others because they didn't know how to write. They're very, very useful as lists and catalogues of what happened, but they're very, very difficult to enjoy. And I think that's true of the films that are, you know, Hollywood is turning out.
Marina, why have myths been consistently such rich source material for composers and musicians?
I think that it's partly because though music comes naturally to us, as literally as one of the first cultural acts that we, you know, can do. I mean, children can sing very, very early, and indeed play instruments early. It's basically an artificial and constructed language. It has an affinity to the idea of the artificial and constructed worlds. If somebody's going to stand on stage and sing to another person, this adds instantly an unreality to, and an intensity to the situation, which then means that you don't have to be realistic. You don't have to set it in any kind of place or time that's recognizable. It can be the enchanted island of Alcina, or indeed the underworld, or Ariadne's island, where she was abandoned by Theseus.
When we listen to Wagner today, given its relationship to Nazism, or listen to a band like Rammstein, given its relationship to the killings in Columbine, should we get the creeps? Because it's impossible to listen, for me, to Wagner, its musical virtuosity aside, without thinking of Nuremberg 1935.
Now, this raises a very, very interesting and sort of profound question, because when we know the background leaks into the story and into that telling of the story. So when we have context, the context changes the meaning of whatever it is, standing alone. It can't stand alone. So some of the myths in the past, for instance, the great Aeschylus cycle of, or the great cycle of Sophocles' tragedies, we don't know. I mean, most of us don't know that much about the society that produced these. We don't go to the Parthenon and see the slaves building it. We don't see slaves at all when we think of ancient Greece. I mean, they were there, but they're not there in our consciousness. There is something about context capturing meanings that makes it impossible, I think, you're right, for us to be pure, if you like, or to be not to bring baggage to the interpretation or the reception of some myths. And Wagner certainly, I mean, it's most unfortunate for those myths, because they far predate the Nazi use of them, but there it is. It's now part of their history, and we certainly have to take it on board when we listen.
Marina Werner, as Westerners, can we be as moved by the myths of Asia, say, as Ursula Le Guin was talking about, as we are by the myths of Gilgamesh and Odysseus and Cronus?
It was wonderful to hear her. I actually have never heard her read before, so it was wonderful to hear her voice. But on terms of Asia, sorry, your question, it's one of the more hopeful signs, I think, of sort of globalization and the multiculturalism that follows, is that we are opening up to all kinds of stories that are from cultures that we were previously ignorant about and often prejudiced about. I mean, certainly Hindu myth was considered to be just a wild, sort of phantasmagoria, sort of terrible rigmarole of all these many-headed and many-armed gods and goddesses, all sort of interchangeable. Well, there are mythographers who have made a great difference to that. Wendy Doniger has written a series of marvellous books, and because she's a Sanskritist and she can read this stuff, she, you know, is able to retell it so that we actually have access to stories that show their tremendous richness and also many, many connections, many affinities with our cultures. There's probably historical exchanges. The Indian
myths. As we have an Indo-European language,
yes.
We presumably have Indo-European myth
yes.
sources.
Yes, but also it helps us see that the fluidity and the lack of fixity of myths to plunge into the great Hindu cycles of gods and goddesses, because they don't have quite the same, you know, the sun isn't always a male god, the moon isn't always, you know, there are differences that are very fundamental, if you like, and help us to see that this is a vocabulary which we can learn and choose and select and forge, as Ursula Le Guin was saying.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and my guest today has been the writer, novelist, essayist Marina Warner. Marina, I want to thank you very much for joining us today in Studio 360.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.